The Supreme Court reading the Constitution says it's illegal. The lawyers we pay in the Terry Miller building say it's illegal.
Lawmakers debate a bill to seize land from the federal government. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 6th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, school districts work to respond to deeper proposed education cuts.
Well, we've been working all evening and all day on this holiday day for us to calculate what these numbers mean.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
Earn a Master of Public Administration from the University of Alaska Southeast online on your schedule while having the structure of the classroom and the accessibility of e-learning. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Of the nearly 200 bills that have been introduced in the Alaska House of Representatives, fewer than 20 have been put to a vote. Today, a controversial bill that would seize millions of acres of land from the federal government joined that group. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
To say Alaska has a complicated relationship with Washington, D.C. would be an understatement. The federal government spends billions in the state, but it also owns millions of acres of land in Alaska and often manages those lands in a way that is not to the liking of the state's leaders. Now, lawmakers are moving legislation to seize that acreage, with a few exceptions. Representative Steve Thompson, a Fairbanks Republican, carried the bill on the House floor.
The bill requires that the federal government turn over the lands held by the federal government, except for lands which are in private ownership, lands used for military or naval purposes or military reservations, and land that was a national park on January 1st of 2015.
If the bill becomes law, Alaska could lay claim to nearly 170 million acres of federal land within the state. But there may be a slight problem.
The Constitution says it's illegal.
As critics, like Anchorage Democrat Andy Josephson, hammered on, the federal government may not feel legally obligated to comply with the bill.
The Supreme Court reading the Constitution says it's illegal. The lawyers we pay in the Terry Miller building say it's illegal. And our past attorney general says it's illegal.
Josephson cited a memo drafted by the legislature's legal department that plainly said as much. He also pointed to unintended consequences, like the state unintentionally seizing United States post offices and interfering with the delivery of mail.
Some people will say, Andy, this is hyperbole, and you're over-dramatizing this. I'm not. I'm just reading the words. I don't mean to over-dramatize it. I really don't. It's just what the words call for.
Other opponents, like Representative Les Guerra of Anchorage, argued that the bill should not be a priority at a time when the state is facing a fiscal crisis. In Utah, such legislation is expected to cost $2 million to litigate.
We're facing a $3.5 billion budget deficit. We don't have the money to litigate a bill that is 100% unconstitutional.
When a similar bill passed in Arizona, its Republican governor vetoed it because of its questionable legality. But defenders of the bill pointed out that Alaskans should still be able to take the battle to court if they want to. Referencing the Declaration of Independence, Wasilla Republican Wes Keller argued that the state has grounds to pursue the land seizure policy.
It's never unconstitutional to fight for what's rightfully yours. That's just that's part of the fundamentals of the pursuit of happiness. It's ours, we can fight for it, whether we're talking 5.5 acres, million acres, or more.
Anchorage Republican Gabrielle Ledoux noted that the state has defied the federal government by legalizing marijuana, and the federal government has not yet interfered.
I suspect that at least some of the lawyers might say that the pot initiative was unconstitutional, and yet we've done that, Colorado has done that, several other states have done that, and guess what? The federal government blinks. If enough states do it, if enough states say what they want and say we're going to take it, we just might get what we want.
The bill passed 27 to 11 on caucus lines. It will now be sent to the Senate. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The Anchorage School Board is discussing the possible ways to cut $29 million from their budget for next year. The $784 million budget passed last month, but it needs to be adjusted for proposed funding cuts from the legislature. Superintendent Ed Graff presented a list of ways to reduce the budget. It includes everything from cutting early learning pilot programs to save $8 million to outsourcing sports programs to save $4 million. Another possibility eliminates about 110 teaching positions and increases class size to save $12 million. School board member Cameron Perez-Verdia says making the cuts is difficult, but they need to go through the practical exercise of identifying priorities because they know at least some cuts are coming. Board President Eric Croft says they'll continue to try to prioritize classroom instruction. The Kenai Peninsula Borough School District is facing a potential revenue loss of nearly $8 million if current proposed budget cuts stand. That's more than double the $3 million cut the district was already preparing for. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has the story.
The school district isn't panicking just yet, but they are seriously reevaluating their budget for fiscal year 2016.
Fortunately, right now, we have general fund balance. We want stability. We've built into our budget stability and reserves, so in the event something happens, we can take care of things.
Peggy Erkineff is the communications specialist for the school district. She says the board was planning on approving the budget today, but those numbers did not include the most recent cuts. Since late last week, she says everyone has been crunching numbers.
And then again, we also know in Juneau everything's fluid. So we've been working all evening and all day on this holiday day for us to calculate what these numbers mean and what it means for contracts that haven't been issued, as well as what it looks like for open positions. We have several open positions right now we're hiring for.
She says the amount the borough can contribute is tied to what the state contributes, which means almost another $1 million in unexpected lost revenue.
That 4.1% reduction to the foundation formula also correlates to a reduction in what the borough's maximum allowable contribution is to the school district. And that amount is $977,000.
So that's a total of more than $5 million of unanticipated cuts. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
The far northern end of the Dalton Highway will remain closed until tomorrow morning. The section south of Dead Horse was also closed for 2 days last week as overflow from the Sag River continues to impact the only supply route for North Slope oil fields. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Dalton closed between milepost 378 and 413 Sunday night as blizzard conditions similar to those that shut it down last week again hampered efforts to channel water off the highway. State crews are using heavy equipment to move snow and build berms along the road where it traverses a wide plain along the Sag River. Department of Transportation spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says the operation is compromised when the weather goes bad.
When we have storms come in, we're not able to keep up with the poor weather and with the water.
State road crews have been battling overflow from the Sag River for weeks, a situation that's been an issue in the past, but is especially bad this year.
The water is so high right now. We have pictures actually where you can see delineators, which are usually 5 feet above the ground. In some places, they're up to the water level, and in some places, you can see about a foot. But what that really means is you've got 4 feet of water just over the road.
Traffic so far north on the Dalton Highway is mostly oil industry related, including a constant train of tractor trailers ferrying supplies and equipment. Nance Larson, a spokeswoman for trucking contractor Carlisle, says the stoppage is affecting projects her company's trucks supply.
But safety is really the first order of business, and so that's where our focus is right now, is making sure that our drivers are operating safely and under safe conditions.
Larson says Carlisle has not halted shipments up the Dalton, but operations have been altered because of the closure near its far northern end.
We are moving freight to and from points that we know we can safely do so and putting cargo in place so that when the road is passable, that we can continue to move freight farther up the road when it's available.
Larson says Carlisle appreciates state efforts to keep the road open. The DOT's Bailey says hydrologists are trying to figure out what's causing the overflow problem to be so bad right now, creating what she describes as a very unique situation.
We very rarely close a Dalton Highway. It's happened, you know, once this winter before this and once 2 or 3 years ago.
The state hopes to get the road passable again Tuesday. Major construction work scheduled to begin this summer will raise impacted portions of the Dalton Highway up to 7 feet and install culverts. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage residents come together to support refugees who were victims of vandalism.
It shows me that they're bold and they come out and like saying this is not right, which is a good thing to see. I mean, I'm impressed.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying dealers throughout Alaska with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser water heaters for more than 28 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com.
Two Village public safety officers graduated from firearm training Friday, becoming the first officers in the 40-year history of the program to be armed. First Sergeant James Holzer of Hoop Burbay and Corporal Michael Galliano of No Attack were certified in a ceremony in Sitka, attended by Governor Bill Walker and Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott. Malott told the pair they will be examples, closely watched by communities across the state.
Those of you who carry firearms, you know why you carry firearms. You are there to keep us safe. You also know that there may be the need to go in harm's way.
Also on hand was Representative Bryce Edgman of Dillingham. Edgman wrote the legislation after VPSO Thomas Madol of Manicotic was shot and killed in 2013. Corporal Galliano, standing with his one-year-old son in his arms, said after the ceremony that Madol's death was one reason he'd gone through with the training. The two trained together when they were first hired.
After Tom died, Tom was in my class here back in 2012. Actually from the same state I'm from, you know, so we were pretty close. And after he died, you know, there was definitely some changes that needed to be made. And, hopefully he didn't die in vain.
Of 21 officers who initially expressed interest in the program, three passed the physical test, background check, and psychological screening necessary to participate in firearm training at the Public Safety Training Academy in Sitka, and two completed the course and graduated. The latest version of a law to mandate sexual abuse prevention education in public schools is unlikely to reach the governor's desk this year. That's according to the Senate Rules Committee Chair Charlie Huggins, who said in a committee Thursday that an expanded version of Aaron's law would likely be a two-year bill. Senator Liesl McGuire's rebranded Alaska Safe Children's Act includes teen dating violence prevention. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Senate Bill 37 still requires public schools to provide age-appropriate K-12 sexual abuse education from Aaron's Law. Anchorage Republican Senator Liesl McGuire says now it also includes teaching 7th through 12th graders about dating violence and prevention.
Violent behavior normally, and this is astonishing, but begins between the ages of 12 and 18. That's when we start to see the signs of it. Only 33% of the teens who have been in a violent relationship are reported to have ever told anyone about that abuse.
McGuire says this part of the bill was largely created due to what happened to 20-year-old Anchorage woman Brianna Moore. Moore's mother, Cindy Moore, gave a tearful testimony describing how her daughter was shot in the head and killed in 2014. Brianna's boyfriend has been charged with murder and is awaiting trial.
How could this have happened to such a strong, beautiful, and independent young woman? Why didn't she say something about the continuing abuse we later discovered? Why did she stay? Why did she not seek help? As parents, why did we not see the signs?
Moore says dating violence education in schools will save other young people. McGuire's rewritten bill gives parents the option of excusing their children from the prevention education. Another added component of the bill would make it mandatory for some volunteer athletic coaches to report child abuse. They'd receive training. Democratic Senator Berta Gardner said that requirement may put off some volunteer coaches.
Even if we recognize that it's important for people to understand what they might be looking for and how they can intervene or get help, be responsive to something that isn't right, we don't want to go so far that people just plain don't want to volunteer.
The bill requires school districts to bear the cost of implementation, but it also repeals other unfunded mandates, like requiring a second round of fingerprints and background checks for certified preschool teachers. Still, school district representatives like Ketchikan Gateway Borough Superintendent Robert Boyle called McGuire's bill another unfunded mandate.
Public schools are the go-to agency when it comes to efficiency, quality, and creating massive changes in the society. We're very good at this. But providing the change needed in our state related to Senate Bill 37 is something I believe we will accept willingly and fully embrace. However, the bill as written is extraordinarily unfair to the public school system if it is to be implemented at no cost.
Four bills addressing Aaron's Law have been introduced this session. Aaron's Law is the one specific piece of legislation Governor Bill Walker said he wanted on his desk during his State of the State address. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
More than 200 people crowded into the main hall of the Northway Mall in Anchorage on Saturday afternoon to show their support for Anchorage's refugee community. The event was organized in response to vandalism aimed at Sudanese refugees. KSKA's Ann Hillman attended the potluck.
People streamed past tables with Thai food, cotton candy, and even Passover potato pancakes, filling their plates and chatting while performers danced in the center of the mall. 10th grader Lu Mei Gooch decided to attend after hearing that "go home" and "leave" were scrawled on the Sudanese men's cars.
We should be feeling Americans. We should be welcoming all the other people from foreign countries and stuff. So I thought it was good to come here to welcome and show, because actions are louder than words.
But Gooch says people need to be welcoming year-round.
Well, I include everybody. I don't leave anyone out because that's not cool. So, like, I invite people who, like, from a different country who don't speak English really well. I talk to them. I'm like, hey, sit with me at lunch. And we talk and we have fun and I meet new friends.
Muhammad is a Somali refugee who attended the event with a friend. Like other refugees, he's not willing to give his full name. Muhammad grew up in Kenya, earned a university degree, and arrived in Anchorage 2 years ago. He says the majority of people treat him fairly, but not all. And he's afraid that speaking up about his past could make it worse.
They kind of feel of a different reaction when they hear my accent. They feel like, oh, he should not be, you know, doing this kind of stuff. He should not be telling me what to do. It feels like, you know, they feel like they don't have to listen to what I'm saying.
But Muhammad says the size of the gathering sends a strong message that acts of intolerance are not acceptable.
It shows me that they're bold and they come out and like saying this is not right, which is a good thing to see. I'm impressed.
Some community leaders are considering making the potluck a monthly gathering. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast offers online degree programs in business, human resources, and management, including the skill set required by Alaska's growing industries. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
A February union complaint has resulted in the resignation of the Matanuska-Susitna Borough's chief medical services official. Clint Vardaman handed in his resignation today. Vardaman directs the borough's emergency responders. His resignation is effective April 20th. Vardaman and two other borough emergency service officials were placed on administrative leave last month. The others are Brian Wallace, head of EMS in the Wasilla-Palmer area, and Gene Wiseman, who heads response for more rural parts of the borough. Borough officials are saying little about the reasons for Vardaman's departure or about the complaint that seems to have sparked it. An internal investigation is ongoing. Last month, Dennis Brodigan resigned from his job as director of the borough's Emergency Services Department, citing personal reasons. Big Lake Fire Chief Bill Gamble has been named interim replacement for Brodigan, and Casey Cook, the borough's emergency manager for disaster planning, is to be Vardaman's interim replacement. At the Haynes School, the new dress code slogan is "Hitch up your britches and cover your bums." The school is now one of many around the U.S. that have put restrictions on yoga pants and leggings. And the new rule has sparked discussions about appropriate school attire and personal choice. KHNS's Emily Files reports on the school's rationale and some students' reactions.
Here's what the problem was, according to Dean of Students Renee Martin. Some students were wearing leggings and yoga pants that were see-through, and there were also some boys who wore pants that sagged and showed their underwear.
Quite honestly, no one needs to know what underclothing you have on or don't have on. And when you can see or not see underclothing, that is impacting educational setting.
She says she talked to individual students about it, but they kept wearing the same thing.
It's like the day that I had to see everybody something something, then I was, okay, it's time.
So the week before spring break, the school made an announcement. People wearing baggy pants, pull them up and wear a belt. Students who want to wear yoga pants or leggings, wear a shirt or skirt that covers your butt. They said the updated restrictions would go into effect after spring break. Martin says this isn't a change to dress code policy, but an update. She reads the section of the policy the restrictions apply to.
Undergarments, including bra straps and sports bras, underwear, are not to be visible.
The hitch up your britches and cover your bum update applies to all grades from K to 12. Martin says even though see-through or baggy pants weren't a problem in younger grades, it's just more equitable to apply restrictions throughout the whole school. A group of high school students sitting together at lunch last week said they think the rule is mainly targeted at girls who wear yoga pants and leggings. Here's Gabrielle Galinsky.
I don't really care. I'm a jeans person. I don't wear leggings. I don't wear yoga pants as often. I just don't really mind the rule.
Rachel Haas says she does wear leggings and yoga pants.
Since we're like going through high school, there's like everyone's having own body issues, like gaining weight and stuff like that. And some people grow out of their jeans, and leggings are just way cheaper. And sometimes it's really hard to get new jeans and stuff like that, so that kind of made me mad.
Rachel is wearing a long, knee-length rainbow sweater. She says she's worn the sweater almost every day in order to keep wearing leggings. A group of middle school girls across the cafeteria had stronger feelings about the rule. Ashley Williamson says not all yoga pants are see-through, so why put restrictions on them all? She also feels like the dress code rules are unfairly enforced.
The authorities are nagging on girls for like leggings, but there are also guys that sag their pants. I've never like heard any teacher like talk to them about that, like ever.
Ashley and her friends say a rule that focuses on whether or not your butt is covered makes them uncomfortable. One girl put it this way: when someone says you need to cover your butt, I'm like, why were you looking at my butt in the first place? High school English teacher Ryan Harms says when he heard how fired up some students were about the dress code, he decided to have class discussions about it. Here's what he heard.
Ranging from sort of a sense of victimization as a woman, that they're being sort of objectified. And then there were other people, and I think maybe you've already heard from some students, who said, that's not a big deal, I'm not violating the dress code anyway, so it doesn't affect me.
Martin says only one student has come to her with concerns about the dress code.
Their biggest concern really was that it was about, are we picking on the girls because of what they're wearing, and that it should never matter what you're wearing, and that you shouldn't be shamed. And I just really reassured him that it wasn't about that. And it wasn't about personal choice of clothing. It wasn't trying to shame anyone about what they're wearing. That it's really about professionalism in an educational setting and appropriate wear for this setting.
A few years ago, the student council appealed a dress code rule banning hats. And now, high schoolers are allowed to wear hats in the building. Martin says if students want to change dress code restrictions, that's the way they can do it. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Big Lake musher Sim Smith won the Kobuk 440 sled dog race this weekend. KNOM's Francesca Fenzi has the story.
In the early hours of Easter morning, the first mushers arrived into Kotzebue at the end of the Kobuk 440 sled dog race. The first place title and over $11,000 purse went to Sim Smith of Big Lake, who arrived just past 6 o'clock Sunday morning after 2 days, 18 hours, and 4 minutes on the trail. It was a first-time win for Smith, who was followed by defending race champion Jeff King. The two mushers traveled neck and neck for much of the race, with King leading from Ambler to the halfway point of Kobuk and back. But Smith finally passed King on the westbound trail Saturday evening at a shelter cabin between Ambler and Selowik.
You know, when I caught Jeff out there at the shelter cabin, I felt pretty good. I really felt like I had a big advantage because I'd made up 26 minutes on that run, so he had a lot of time to make up at that point.
He passed me while I was stopped. I stopped 20 minutes at that shelter cabin, and I'm glad they did. They ate really, really well. They cleaned out a whole cooler while I was there, but that's where I was when he went by. There was a bunch of school kids and snow machines there going to the hot springs. And it became apparent, I mean, my dogs have a really full stomach. They ate a lot at that shelter cabin, and I had to back off.
The race was close, and tensions appeared to be high as the pair flew through several upriver checkpoints. But at the finish line, both competitors shook hands and congratulated each other on a great race.
There was no keeping up with you this time. Well done.
Smith even surprised King with an offer to remove booties from his rival's team.
Shall we pull the booties off, Jeff?
That'd be great.
Kotzebue musher John Baker was next to arrive at the finish. Reporting in Kotzebue, I'm Francesca Fenzi.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Rachel Waldholz in Sitka, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Emily Files in Haines, and Francesca Fenzi in Kotzebue. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The American Lung Association of Alaska invites you to join their premier annual cycling event, the Clean Air Challenge, on May 9th. This family-friendly one-day event begins in Talkeetna and offers routes ranging from 10 to 100 miles. This fundraiser benefits the American Lung Association to support lung health programs across Alaska. For more information, visit cleanairchallengeak.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.